So welcome back, everybody. I've just got two questions. Whether you use cannabis medically, recreationally, or religiously, what makes you think that you have the right to use it? Second question is, what right has the government to stop you using it? Our next speaker is a retired barrister who knows all about rights. He's an expert. Maybe he can answer those questions. Please give a warm welcome from South Wales, Roger Warren Evans.
One minor apology in advance. I'm going to have to leave at 3:15 to get the train back to Swansea, to my hometown. I'll get there by midnight if I leave here at 3:15. That's the forecast. I'm the newcomer here, really, because it would have been pointless having me here last year, 12 months ago. It would just be like, oh, most lawyers are, a complete wet blanket, because there would have been nothing to say. Simply, it's against the law, it's against the law, it's against the law. It would have been pointless to have me 6 months ago. Because in September, as many courts, there were people here who were before the courts in June, July. Lyndon and I were at a case down in Maidstone in July. All the judge could say, well, sorry, it's against the law. October the 2nd hasn't arrived. And so there would have been absolutely no point whatever in my coming along to an occasion such as this. But 24 weeks ago, the legal world did change. And it's a very fundamental change, and I want to try and explain in the time that I've got the implications of that change. Now, let me spell out what I'm doing here. First, I'm here as a barrister. I specialised in human rights cases in the 1960s, when many of you were just a gleam in someone's eye, if even that. So I took my first case to Strasbourg for the European Court of Human Rights in 1966. I haven't been practising ever since. But I'm retired now and I have the complete freedom. You can't pay me to represent you. I can't receive any money. I haven't got a practicing certificate. And therefore, I have complete freedom of opinion and complete freedom of expression. Incidentally, I joined Matt Southwell in a broadcast coming out on the 28th. Watch the broadcast on BBC Two, 11:20, after Newsnight, in the series Counterblast, which Matt Southwell of National Drug Users Network has put together as his personal views, and I'm there as his personal legal advisor on the subject. That's 11:20 on the 28th of March. It's a national program. It's on national BBC Two, not just on the regions. So we'll get it in Wales, even though it's broadcast in England, and that's at 11:20. Counterblast. So I'm completely free to express my opinions. Let me make it clear, I don't suppose this will be popular, but I'm here as a very active member of the Labour Party of 38 years standing without a break. I'm a Labour Party activist, so don't expect me to apologise. I shall be working very hard for the return of a Labour government when the election comes, because I certainly don't want to see the other lot in. So I won't go further than that. I'm here as a council member of Liberty, the civil rights organisation. And Liberty passed a resolution at their AGM last year, which went far beyond the legalisation of cannabis. The Liberty AGM, that is all the members of Liberty, voted overwhelmingly in favour of a change in the law which would give access to lawful supply of all psychoactive substances. Right? That is, a large majority of the civil rights community came to the conclusion not only should cannabis be legalised, because there isn't a separate case for cannabis as a matter of law, but all psychoactive substances should be legalised and there should be a system of lawful supply. And number four, I'm here as a boring old fart because I've never even smoked a cigarette, less alone a spliff or a joint. So I've never even smoked tobacco. So look, I am not a participant in your party. I'm simply an enthusiast for the cause of human rights. And I'm not only delighted to be here, I'm very proud to be here along with Alan Mason and Philip Lockwood and those who are bearing the brunt of the contest at the present time. Phil's here. I can't see Alan. Is Alan with us? And Alan, yes. And Alan's made an incredible breakthrough with the statement of case he's got for the Court of Appeal issued in the next in the last 2 days. So I'm proud to be here standing shoulder to shoulder with them, contesting the abuse of power, because that's what the Misuse of Drugs Act is, 1971. It was preceded by the Drugs Act that I studied when I was a young barrister, namely the Dangerous Drugs Act of 1920. It's the same principles. And someone asked this morning, where did it all come from? Well, it came from religious fervor. The 1920 Act was passed after the Treaty of Versailles when a very fervent American President Wilson came over to Europe and tried to persuade all the victorious countries of the First World War to prohibit alcohol and to prohibit narcotics. And, of course, you can imagine that all the governments of Europe looked at this American president with his religious fervor and said, what, prohibit alcohol? You must be joking. And so no one prohibited alcohol. But because, and Caroline made this point this morning, because the consumption of narcotics was very much a minor activity and a non-European activity, every European country at the Treaty of Versailles in 1919 said, yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir, to America, and came back home and legislated for the prohibition of narcotics. Belgium did that. The Belgian law, which Lyndon, with his fantastic publication here, he's taught me all I know about the sector. He was interviewing the Belgian minister. Well, the Belgian law was 1920 as well. The French law was 1920. The Swedish law was 1920. All these countries went back and introduced this ridiculous prohibition of narcotics in order to please a religiously zealot who happened to be president of America. So that's where it comes from, religious zealotry. And the American religious right is still there. Now, I want to try and answer three questions in the time that I've got. In the last 24 weeks, because it's only 24 weeks, remember, when you get impatient with lawyers, remember, they've only had 24 weeks to adjust to a change which is absolutely seismic in their education. I want to answer three questions. What has happened? How has it happened? And where are the best prospects for using the courts to achieve reform? And also say a word, if I've got time, on where the pitfalls lie of this particular reform tactic, because it is a method, a tactic. Right, well, first of all, what has happened? What happened on October the 2nd when the Human Rights Act was brought into force? Suddenly, the English legal system was faced with a system of two-tier legal reasoning. Let me explain what I mean. Lawyers like me, right up to last year, have been educated as lawyers. There'll be some lawyers probably, or those of you who've done a bit of law in your, certainly Eddie has done the law. We were all educated in a single-tier system of reasoning. There can at any one time, so the theory goes, only be one law, one interpretation of the law. It either comes from a statute of parliament, or it comes from case law, common law, precedent, history, doesn't matter. English lawyers are trained to believe there is only one law. We've never had a written constitution, we've never had a constitutional law overriding the day-to-day law, we've never had anything like that. And so English lawyers are single track. They ask the question, what's the law? Once we've discovered what the law is, we then apply it to the facts. And when you go along to a jury trial, which is virtually the only place in Europe where you now have jury trials, the judge decides the question of law, and the jury decides the question of fact. So it is a single-tier system, or at least it was until October the 2nd, just before Christmas. Because once the Human Rights Act came into force in this country, there was a second upper tier of law. And those principles, which we're going to look at shortly here, are said to be incorporated fully into English law. And the Section 6 of the Human Rights Act says, no public authority in this country shall act in a way which is incompatible with a convention right. So whatever the law says here on the old single tier, there is a higher tier of law, call it a constitutional law, if you like. Some people have said it's introducing, in a way, a written constitution by the back door. And it is. It's a two-tier system of reasoning. So every lawyer getting up in the morning has to go into the office and check, first of all, what's the day-to-day law? And then he's got to think, is there any conflict between that and the second tier? And it won't surprise you to know that really that's quite difficult. I mean, it's rather like someone who is an adherent of a very authoritarian religion that has one Ayatollah Khomeini, who has one source of doctrine, and only one, and is suddenly told, well, you know, the Ayatollah can be wrong. Now, that is a very, very difficult proposition for English lawyers to accept. No other lawyers have this problem in Europe. Why? Because every other country that I know, and I've practiced law in France and Germany, every other country has two-tier law already. They have constitutional law, they have constitutional courts. Germany called it the basic law, the Grundgesetz. They have two different types of courts. When this court dealing with day-to-day law finds that it has a constitutional issue, it immediately refers it to the constitutional court. The constitutional court decides that issue and sends it back to the other court. So every lawyer on the continent has been trained to handle two-tier law with his mother's milk. English lawyers, until 24 weeks ago, never had to do this at all. So they are in real shtuck. I mean, Alan Mason had the terrifying experience. It was when we contacted each other on the net, first of all. 10 members of the bar refusing to take his case. Now, I know Alan thinks that that's a matter of conspiracy. I actually don't think it's a matter of conspiracy. I think they're all terrified of being the first ones to go over the top, because making a public speech in a public court is a risky thing to do with your own personality and your own reputation. They don't want to go over the top and be the first ones to make a cock-up of two-tiered reasoning, because two-tiered reasoning is difficult. I started learning it in the 1960s when the Human Rights Court, when you could go to the Human Rights Court, but you couldn't argue, put the same arguments in the English courts. It's difficult. It's a new way of being a lawyer. So, that's what has happened, and it all happened on the morning of Monday, October the 2nd, year 2000. And most lawyers haven't yet woken up to the fact that it's happened. How? That's my answer to the question, what has happened? How has it happened? Well, it's happened by stages, and we, and I mean the UK and the English lawyers, have been very, very important throughout in introducing this change. The European Convention of Human Rights, and let me add, and Fundamental Freedoms, because that's in the title, and I think what's at issue here with the drugs legislation is much more of a breach of a fundamental freedom than a human right. But the treaty is called the European Convention of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms. It's listed in the magnificent document that Alan's got with him in the statement of case for the Court of Appeal for 2nd of April. It is a question of asserting fundamental freedoms. It was negotiated in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, when everyone was keenly aware of what happened in the fascist state in Germany and the way in which that completely suppressed individual freedoms. And so the political atmosphere of this document is that of 1951. And it's virtually all recognizable as English legal drafting. Right? You can tell the bits that have been put in, at least I can, and those of us who know different systems of law, we can tell the bits that were put in by the French lawyers and the bits that were put in by the English lawyers in the course of that negotiation. Now, the first stage was completely ineffective in terms of individual rights. Stage one said, this convention can only be enforced by a state taking an action against another state. That is, the idea was that if a German citizen had been oppressed by the post-war German government, then the French government could take the German government to court for having oppressed the German citizen. So it was a way, that was the original idea. It proved to be completely pointless, and nothing happened really in the 50s and the early 60s. Until Labour won the second election in the 60s, and we, and I'm proud to be Labour, we introduced the right of individual appeal to Strasbourg for a breach of human rights. That meant the individual, and I took the first case to Strasbourg under that legislation, and won against my own government, pleased to hear. Case of a 13-year-old Pakistani boy who was wrongfully turned back from Heathrow Airport, but the government was forced to pay his fare back here, and he won the appeal. So in that second phase, the individual could take action. Yeah. Many of us did take action on behalf of individuals, but you had to exhaust all your English remedies before you could go to Strasbourg. Just imagine. I mean, the case of Muhammad Alam, the poor guy who was sent back to Pakistan, it was easy enough because there were no remedies. There was no industrial appeal trial and no immigration appeal tribunal at that stage. They introduced those after the case. But you had to go all the way through. Someone like Alan Mason or Phil Lockwood had to go through the trial, go through the Court of Appeal, go to the House of Lords before you were entitled to take your case at the fourth stage to Strasbourg. Well, of course, most people sensibly didn't spend the 4 or 5 years of their lives doing that. And so very few cases in that stage two got to Strasbourg. But stage three was midnight on Monday, the 2nd of October, the year 2000. And from that moment, you have been able to put forward these arguments that I'm going to be talking to you about in every English court and every English tribunal. So you can raise it in the magistrates' courts. The magistrates have been having huge training sessions all over the country. I think sometimes the magistrates have had more training than some of the solicitors, duty solicitors. But there are huge training courses for magistrates. Industrial tribunals, we've heard the case of the teacher who's turned away. I'm sure the industrial tribunals will have a great deal to say. The definition of wrongful dismissal, as implemented by the industrial tribunals, will certainly be affected in the drugs field by the legislation. I'm absolutely sure about that. So this is how it's happened. It's gradually changed. It's a treaty where there are originally 14 members, and there are now 41 members. There are 41 states of Europe, including several of the component states of the former Soviet Union, who have signed up to the European Convention of Human Rights. So it has the authority of a very large number of countries that have all voluntarily signed up to exactly the same set of words. Right? So that is, it is becoming, unlike the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which remains pie in the sky, has never been incorporated into any system of national law. The European Convention was designed and drafted from the outset by English lawyers for the purpose of being incorporated into national systems of law. Now, that process of incorporation was in fact quite a difficult one. If you think about it, you've got 500 years of traditional thinking in a single-tier system. How on earth, without a fundamental rethink of the system, do you introduce the idea of a second higher order of law? Very, very difficult. And the result is that the 1998 Act is pretty tortuous and difficult. I'm not going to try and lecture you on the whole of the 1998 Act. I do a modest four-hour session on that at different stages. But there's no question doing that. It is a tortuous and difficult system. But you can imagine how difficult it is when you've had 500 years of single-tier thinking suddenly to introduce the idea that that single-tier may be wrong. The oddities of the English system of incorporation do affect all of you here. Because, first of all, the government refused to set up a human rights commission. Equal opportunities, there's a commission on racial equality. Sorry, equal opportunities commission. Race, there's a commission on racial equality. There were strong arguments that the government should set up a human rights commission that would, as it were, be a public body charged with ensuring that this legislation was enforced in practice. The government, and they say it's only a deferment, not a refusal, but the government refused to establish a human rights commission. Therefore, there is no body to whom anyone can turn. Alan, Philip, they no one to whom they could turn in these cases for advice on the general operation of the law. My phone is going regularly most of the week with people who really should be ringing up a human rights commission if there were one. But there isn't. This system is what's called victim-led. The only person who is allowed to bring an action or to raise an argument under this is the victim or the would-be victim. That is, you can raise it if you have been a victim of a wrongful arrest or if you're threatened with a wrongful action by any public authority. And remember, public authority is very widely defined. It includes anyone performing a public function. That means a lot of the major charities, Barnardo's, NSPCC, a lot of the major charities, remember, they're administering public money, they're performing public functions. A lot of residential homes run the Distressed Gentlefolks Aid Association, which runs a lot of charitable homes for old people. Definitely a public authority for this purpose. So the abuse of old people within those homes would be directly actionable under the Human Rights Act. There's no constitutional court, and so we've got the rule that every court in the land must take into account these arguments. So we've moved in a different direction there. On the continent, these would have been made the job of a constitutional court. But here, we haven't got a constitutional court. So we've got a very, very attractive solution, I think an attractive solution, that every court must enforce this law. Every tribunal must enforce this law. Every industrial tribunal listening to every wrongful dismissal case must enforce this law. So, in an odd way, the absence of a constitutional court sitting up there, and like the American Constitutional Court overruling Florida and allowing Bush to become president. The American Constitutional Court overruled the Florida Constitutional Court. Well, in this case, because the issue was immediately referred to constitutional courts, not the ordinary courts. Well, we haven't got any constitutional court here, and therefore every court, every tribunal is fair game and has a separate duty under the Act to enforce the human rights legislation. I'm coming now to the, as far as I'm concerned, the crown of the Human Rights Act and the Convention, which is Article 8 of the Convention. Many of the articles in the Convention, and there are 13 relevant articles, are ideas which we, from our English tradition, put into the Convention in the first place. Right to a fair trial, right to an unbiased judge, no imprisonment, no penalty to be imposed unless there was a prior law in force at the time of the offence. There are lots of principles here, right of freedom of opinion, freedom of assembly, right to join a trade union, freedom of association. All those are, if any of you have done any law at all, would recognize all those as rights which were established in English law quite independently of the Human Rights Act. And there have been some English lawyers who say, well, goodness me, 10 out of 12 of these rights we've already got anyway. Big deal. Because we're just as good. We told these foreigners about these rights in 1951, and all they're doing is re-importing them. Now, I mean, that's the sort of way it comes over from some right-wing critics of it, and there is some truth in it. Because it's quite true that if I took you through all the 13 rights, the 13 articles that are creating rights, you'd say, well, you know, that's obvious. We know about that. But there is... I mean, there's one minor one which we didn't have, which has already had the dramatic effect, and that's the right to marry any person of your choice under Article 12. The only one of the most obvious breaches of that, which was repealed on September the 25th, just a week before October the 2nd, was the Salvation Army's rule that a Salvation Army officer can only marry another Salvation Army officer. I didn't know it was there, but I mean, it is there. A Salvation Army officer, once commissioned in God's army, can only marry another commissioned officer. Well, they changed that rule because they didn't want on Monday, October the 2nd, they didn't want anyone suing them under the Human Rights Act because Article 12 says it's a right to marry. That's minor. There is a nasty little article, which is the right to property. I say it's nasty because it's the only article in the whole of the convention where the corporate sector has got its teeth into it, and the property rights under that article, I'm ashamed to say, apply to artificial persons as well as natural persons. That is, they apply to Rio Tinto Zinc PLC exactly as they apply to Alan Buffrey, that is, to an artificial person, a legal person, as the lawyers call it, as well as a natural person. And not an inanimate, but an abstract object. Animal, vegetable, or mineral, abstract. Okay? And a company is simply an abstract person. An abstraction which is gifted with legal personality. And that is the property, the ownership of property, and the protection of property rights is protected by the Human Rights Act. But it is the only one, remember. All these other rights we're going to talk about, in particular Article 8, do not apply to artificial or legal persons. They apply only to natural persons. So in the remainder of time that I've got, I'm going to talk only about Article 8. Okay? So Article 8, for me, would you like to start distributing? There are copies for everyone, because I want you to keep this in your top pocket. It is the very important, the most important and distinctive document. Article 8, right to respect for private and family life. Everyone has the right to respect for his private and family life, his home, and his correspondence. Remember, this is long before, this language is long before the days of feminism, 1951, and it his means his or her, all right? It's simply that this is in exactly the same form as it was enacted in 1951. And the courts in interpreting this have said quite clearly that there are four different packages of rights here. There's private life, there's family life, there's home, the physical home, and then there is correspondence, under which a lot of the wiretapping, telephone tapping, the practice of prison authorities in opening prisoners' letters, for instance, that comes under correspondence. And so we've got four different zones of human experience, if you like, which have their own developed case law, and which over the last 50 years have been expanded by the European judges, and will now be open for expansion by the English judges in their own way. So private life, family life. Family life was the one in which I got the government in 1966, because Muhammad Alam, 13-year-old boy, said that he was the father he was the son of his father, who was standing on the other side of the barrier. The immigration officer didn't believe him, and I said that was clearly an issue raising his right of family life, and he didn't have a fair trial of that under Article 5. Therefore, it was a breach of the Constitution, a breach of the Convention. Now, and we're going to be focusing only on one of these. I'm not going to be dealing with home, although there is a school of thought which says that the growing of cannabis in your own home, if it's within your own curtilage, is a breach of Article 8, the right of home, as well as it is a breach of your private life. It's clearly not your family or your correspondence, but it could be private life and it could be home. Now, that is a very remarkable proposition. There is nothing in English law which, as it were, has that breadth and potential penetration. We've always found it difficult to get together any concept of a right of privacy in English law. Even private correspondence, the courts have really struggled to give people privacy as a matter of common law, and there's been no legislation on it. Until these words, and these words are gradually going to sink in, are going to change many, many aspects of our lives. Now then, move on to number two, because it's the logical structure of number two which offers us campaigners the true opportunity. There shall be no interference by a public authority, remember that is very widely defined, includes NSPCC, no interference by a public authority with the exercise of this right, namely a right of private life, except such as is in accordance with the law, and there you have the conjunction between first tier law and second tier law. That's the exact point where it occurs. First of all, except such as is in accordance with the law, the police officer has certainly got to have his search warrant in order if he comes into your house. It's not dispensing with that. But then we go on to ask a second question. Even if the search warrant is in order, is this action by the police necessary in a democratic society in the interests of? It's a second, that's where the second tier reasoning comes in. It's not enough for the policeman to say, well, I got my warrant, get out of my way. He has to satisfy, the state has to satisfy the second arm of that paragraph 8.2. And it's magic, because look at it, look at what it says. It isn't open-ended, and this is brought out brilliantly, incidentally, in Alan Mason's counsel's opinion for April the 2nd. The counsel has got it. He says it is for the prosecution to identify which of these public sector interests is going to be pursued as a matter of court argument. So we've got to let's take the example Daniel Westlake waiting to go to the Court of Appeal now, 22-year-old, a tiny amount of cannabis. You'll tell me what the tiny amount was. Anyway, it was a tiny amount of cannabis. 22-year-old, no family responsibilities, living with his mum. And the question is his arrest and persecution necessary in a democratic society for national security? Pull the other one. Public safety or the economic well-being of the country? Another one. For the prevention of disorder or crime? For the protection of health or morals? What do we say about that? Because it won't be morals. The best betting is that the CPS lawyers are preparing to defend themselves on the ground of the protection of health. That seems to be their only chance. I mean, they're desperate to get more time to think this through, because the truth is there isn't a decent defense for them here. The protection of the rights and freedoms of others? Well, what was Alan doing? What was Phil doing? Wasn't impacting on the rights or freedoms of others. So there is the only possible ground, protection of health. Protection of Alan's health, ill health, protection of Phil's ill health. Well, the state can't intervene on the grounds that it's protecting you from your own ill health. That would be balmy. So it must be the protection, it must be intervening in order to secure the health of others. How does the intervention then run? How can it be justified within those terms? I don't know, and I rather think that the Home Office lawyers are in a state of panic. They want to defer any battle on this ground as long as possible. That's why we're not getting any new prosecutions from the police. It's not because, you know, for good police reasons, they've got other priorities. It's because the CPS, I believe, is terrified of having to fight on this simple ground. Because they know if they lose a simple personal possession case under Section 5 of the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971, the whole legal structure will collapse. The whole pack of cards will come down. And when we say that it is only more action on the streets that will do it, I believe that it is an action, it is a judgment of the Court of Appeal handing down what's called a declaration of incompatibility to Jack Straw, saying, look, we've had a look at this, and you cannot justify mass criminalisation under this provision. It's incompatible. You can do what you like to, and I think they probably would say, oh, well, international drug dealers deserve what they get. I don't think they'd go as far as Caroline. But nevertheless, I am sure as I can be that they will strike down Section 5 of the 1971 Act. And probably, as in Alan's case and in Phil's case, they will probably strike down the cultivation for personal use as well. Because it's so closely related to right of respect for private life and home. So that is where we are. Where are the best prospects for making progress? Well, my advice to you is once this has passed, forget all about the detailed law. You know, read this and try and identify areas where there is injustice. Concentrate on the individual injustice. Because it's the individual injustice, the sense that something is wrong, which will be the trigger for all these successful actions. Ultimately, this convention is all about the personal injustice. It's not about the law. It's about the act of the police or the act of any public authority doing something that is wrong. It says in section 6 of the Act, it shall be unlawful for any public authority to act in any way which is incompatible with this convention. It shall be unlawful. It is. And that means that, I mean, Lyndon and I disagree. I mean, I think the Smoky Bears party at Portsmouth, which he reported on, I am appalled by the use of police dogs against people. I think, and sniffer dogs against people. That is, they actually use dogs to sniff people up and down in all crevices and crannies to try and identify the presence or absence of cannabis. That, I have no doubt, is a wrongful interference with private life. No doubt at all. If only someone would take it. I mean, one of my jokes, I'm still active as the director of a property company in London, and we owned the shopping centre at the Gorbals. And the shopping centre there, I regularly went along to have a word with the chemist there, was one of our tenants. And her practice was to make methadone patients stand in a queue in the middle of the shop and consume their methadone in full public view of a... I mean, that is appalling. That's not a breach of the law, but it is an act on the part of a public authority which is a failure of respect for private life, isn't it? Well, all those will be caught. A lot of them will go, rather as the Salvation Army changed its rule in advance of being caught out, a lot of them will, I think, go as the analysis is done and they trawl through their procedural rules. Others won't go quite so easily. Where are the pitfalls then, before I finish? Because those are the opportunities. Remember, focus on the individual wrong and then ask the lawyers, think up a way of doing something about it. It is a matter of thinking it up because this is pretty tortuous reasoning, getting from single-tier reasoning to two-tier reasoning, and I don't claim any great credit for it. It's a difficult task, and indeed, I don't blame some of those lawyers that are trying to stay out of the limelight in the last few weeks because they simply know that they wouldn't survive. The pitfalls of the next few months, and I think the next few months are critical, lie in this field. First of all, as far as the drugs legislation is concerned, the Human Rights Act really only bites on personal, private consumption. No drugs dealer bringing in a large amount through Heathrow, the sort of people that that Eddie had to deal with in his police career, none of them will ever be able to put up a Human Rights Act defense. Because, you know, bringing in a couple of kilos, well, it's not a right of respect for your private or family life. That hasn't been infringed. You're trading, and it's a fair cop. It's against the law. So don't believe that it's going to strike at everything. It's only going to strike at that magic zone of individual sanctity, individual sovereignty, which is the individual's prime entitlement. That is where it will strike. Number two, complex cases on the facts. And I know this does annoy people, but I must state it. Because the judges aren't used to this system either, and there are 100 High Court judges whom this could come up before, complex cases on the facts can let the lawyers off the hook so that they simply say, well, on the facts, this wasn't a sort of case which human rights were engaged, because I find, as a matter of fact, that blah, 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 blah. So the simpler the case on the facts, the better chance that campaigning lawyers have got of getting a decision on the principle. Complex cases on fact are very difficult to handle, and there may be grave injustice. I don't want to say anything about that. I don't mean anything about that. But you do need a simple case in order to force the judges to deal with the question of principle. The third fascinating issue, which we will get an answer to within 3 or 4 weeks, I think, probably in Allen's case in Carlisle, may even happen on the morning of Monday the 2nd. I wish I could be there. Is this: how will the state justify its interference with the cannabis consumers' rights under Article 8? Which of these grounds will it choose? Because it's got to choose one, or two, or three. If it can find two, it's a better man than I am. But they've got to do something, or else they're going to have to concede the case. So that is a fascinating issue. where is the state going to pitch its tents in order to defend against the oncoming hordes? It's got to be there, somewhere in that paragraph. And fourthly, how will the individual judges react? Because you can see that this question of what is necessary in a democratic society in the interests of, that whole test, which has come to be called the proportionality test, that's how the European Court has described it, it's not a bad shorthand term. That test is all things to all men. That test produces one answer in the hands of a liberal judge and another answer in the hands of an autocratic judge. So a lot is going to depend on exactly how the dice fall, which judges get allocated to these cases, and they're definitely pitfalls. But I'm absolutely sure that we're facing a very exciting year. The change for the lawyers is absolutely massive. It is literally revolutionary in terms of their training and their reasoning. It's not fully understood there by anyone yet. And there are no rabbits just to pull out of a hat. This is an agonizing process. I mean, you're concerned here with political action. I'm concerned with getting action through the courts. And I say that if I get some action through the courts, it will give the politicians the excuse they need to trigger off a change in the law. They'll be able to say, it's those bloody lawyers again. It's Europe. It's Europe and lawyers. Good common sense Englishmen wouldn't change the law, but we've been forced to change the law. It was drafted by the English in the first place. And so I think that the courts will come in and give the politicians a perfect hook, or get them off the hook without ever conceding the case. I'm proud to be here with you today. I'm proud that we're travelling in the same direction, and I'm sure we'll get there. Right, I've got them. I've got